sacred sites. We've known our sacred sites are not to be negotiated.
October 11 is Indigenous Peoples Day, on which we honor the original people, the Indigenous nations that continue to thrive today.
This is where we are right now. We either bring about Third World War, Fourth World War, or destroy ourselves, or disturb nature so much nature is going to act so strongly, well, there's no way to survive. But if we find this to be true, then we correct, change, and stop this wrongdoing and make this life beautiful, clean again.
And we honor Mother Earth.
Because we know, as Indigenous people who are citizens of this terrible empire beast that is the United States, that it is our responsibility to free the rest of the world from the greatest purveyor of violence throughout the globe, which is the United States.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Jacqueline Batiste. The number of cities and states that have made Indigenous Peoples Day an official holiday keeps growing. The holiday is celebrated throughout the United States on the second Monday in October. In Canada, it's called National Indigenous Peoples Day, Indigenous Peoples Day in Taiwan, and is also referred to as First Peoples Day, National Indigenous Peoples Day, or Native American Day. Indigenous Peoples Day began as a counter-celebration held on the same day as the U.S. federal holiday of Columbus Day. Columbus represents the violent history and horror of colonization on the original people of the Western Hemisphere. It started in Berkeley, California in 1992 to coincide with the 500th anniversary of the arrival of Columbus to the Americas on October 12, 1492. Fawn Sharp is the president of the National Congress of American Indians. She spoke at the historic gathering of Native Nations at the National Mall on July 29th of this year to demand an end to treaty violations and protection for sacred sites.
It's appropriate that we are here on the mall between the Lincoln Memorial and the United States Capitol. Long before there was a country, the Creator called our ancestors to these sacred lands. Long before there was a Congress, long before there was a state, long before there was a District of Columbia, these were sacred lands that our Almighty Creator called each and every one of us to. And while we have ceded millions of acres of precious land by treaty, we've never relinquished that spiritual connection that we share with our Almighty Creator, with each other, and with our sacred sites. Through the generations of teachings, it is our duty to ensure that sacred sites are protected not only for our generation, but all those generations that will follow. We understand and recognize that in this very moment that is being threatened. We understand in this very moment on this hill, on both sides of Capitol Hill, behind doors, in rooms of negotiating, there's a powerful force in this country that is seeking to exploit for profit our sacred sites. But like all those generations that have gone before us, we know you cannot put a price tag on our sacred sites. We've known our sacred sites are not to be negotiated. We will uphold this country, lead this country to protect sacred sites all over the world. That is our duty. That is our charge. That is our calling. On behalf of the National Congress of American Indians, we stand firm in the mission. We honorably accept that mission that is represented by this totem, and we will support and honor our sacred sites. Siokwil Chihatsi.
Fawn Sharp, president of the National Congress of the American Indian, on the National Mall, where a blessing ceremony took place for a 25-foot totem pole carved by the Lummi Nation House of Carvers. The totem pole has been presented across the nation where there are strongholds of Indigenous resistance. We thank Esther Iverum, host and producer of On the Ground, from Pacifica Radio WPFW in Washington.
Revitalize, revitalize. Put your hands up in the air right now. Revitalize, revitalize. Raise your fist high in the air right now. Revitalize, revitalize. Put your hands up in the air right now. Revitalize, revitalize. Raise your fist high while we rise.
You've heard about the Green New Deal, but how about the Red Deal? Melanie Yazzie co-authored The Red Deal, a revolutionary program to fight environmental catastrophe and secure a livable future for humanity and the planet. Melanie Yazzie, an indigenous revolutionary, a community activist and professor, a co-founder of The Red Nation, a grassroots indigenous liberation organization. She spoke with Pacifica producer Ken Yale about The Red Deal, The Red Nation, and the significance of Indigenous Peoples Day.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, Ken. So, I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation. I'm also an assistant professor of Native American Studies and American Studies at the University of New Mexico. I am also co-founder and have been a longtime organizer with a grassroots Indigenous liberation organization called the Red Nation. The Red Nation was founded almost exactly 7 years ago, actually, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in November of 2014. We were seeing that, you know, there was a national conversation around police violence in the United States. But something we noticed was that there wasn't a lot being written or talked about when it came to Native people in policing, even though we found out quite quickly that Native people are actually killed at higher rates by police than any other demographic in the United States. And so we started to call this kind of constellation of social and economic and police violence, state violence, border town violence. And so we started to organize. We got Indigenous Peoples Day established in Albuquerque the next fall in September of 2015 to replace Columbus Day. It was a huge deal. We sent delegations up to Standing Rock to the NoDAPL front lines the next fall in 2016. We started to do solidarity campaigns for Native people who were living on the streets. We call them our unsheltered relatives. We don't call them homeless because how can Native people be homeless in their own homelands is something that we say. And so doing solidarity feeds, clothing them, providing housing for Native folks, especially poor working class folks, people on the streets. We've been very active trying to stop resource extraction and trying to stop violence against Native women, youth, and LGBTQ2 relatives. We also have been very conscious over the years of developing very clear politics about what we mean when we call ourselves revolutionaries. We believe in left internationalism. We believe in solidarity with folks who are struggling in the global South, for example, our Indigenous relatives in Latin America. We've sent multiple delegations to Palestine. So internationalism is very important to who we are because we know as Indigenous people who are citizens of this terrible empire beast that is the United States, that it is our responsibility to free the rest of the world from the greatest purveyor of violence throughout the globe, which is the United States, through its imperial project. And so we take that responsibility very seriously, whilst we also believe in liberation for our people here, the liberation of the land from the violence of extractive capitalism, from the violence of white supremacy and settler colonialism. And we very staunchly believe in the leadership of Native women and LGBTQ2 relatives and youth. If you look at any front line that's happening right now throughout Turtle Island, where there's an Indigenous struggle going on, it's those people who are leading it, and that's happening for a reason. And so this is how we see ourselves as Indigenous revolutionaries, always trying to create a vibrant, beautiful future, not just for Indigenous people and our people, but for all of humanity, especially as we're staring down this ticking time bomb of climate change and climate disaster. And we must truly come together to have a future for all species on this planet.
Since this interview will air on the week of Indigenous Peoples Day, is there a significance of this day in this historical moment?
Indigenous people across North America and across the world have, you know, actually successfully, because of frontline struggle, prevented a massive amount of carbon emissions to enter the atmosphere and have been doing really a lot of work, right, to curb climate change. And so this year, everywhere that IPD is happening, those events are talking about climate change and how Indigenous people are really, you know, I'm going to use the word the vanguard, actually, I would say, of resistance against climate change all over the world. And so our IPD march and rally will be focused on that. The Red Nation is holding our own events online and then in Albuquerque, but we're sending comrades to Cochabamba in Bolivia, the historic gathering a decade ago, right, where 30,000 Indigenous people came together and drafted the Cochabamba Agreement, the People's Accords, providing a radical Indigenous anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist program for how we must be addressing climate change that very much inspired the Red Deal, the book we published earlier this year, and very much inspires all of the efforts that we do. So we're sending comrades to Washington, D.C. to protest Line 3, to protest ongoing resource extraction funding from Congress and the Biden administration. And we are gravely serious because, you know, the IPCC report that came out really showed what we're up against. And if we don't do something, what is going to happen? And for Indigenous people, it is an impossibility not to have a future. Literally, our entire ways of life and being are premised on securing a future, you know, for generations that we don't know yet and will never know. That's literally what like Indigenous politics are premised on, you know, in our knowledge and our language systems. And so the prospect of not having a future, I think for me as an Indigenous revolutionary, is an impossibility. And the only way to ensure that we do have a future is to act, and to act militantly, and to act now at numbers larger than I think any of us have ever seen, even those of us who are seasoned organizers.
Thank you for that. And I think one of the examples of Indigenous leadership and the vanguard role you described is the Red Deal. What is the Red Deal, and how is that different from a Green New Deal or some of the kinds of mainstream ways that people are talking about dealing with the environmental crises?
Sure, big question. The Red Deal is a program for action. The subtitle, right, is called Indigenous Action to Save Our Earth. What we really advance in this that is quite different than at least the AOC-driven kind of version of the Green New Deal is something that's very movement-based, right? We're not really interested in kind of the reformist approach that a lot of folks take when it comes to environmental politics at the national level in the United States. Oftentimes, I think what happens with the conversation around environmental politics is it's about consumerism and choice. We just need to like recycle more, you know, or we need to buy green, buy local, go to your local co-op. And those things, they do matter, right? But we're not terribly interested in individual actions because we're a movement-oriented approach to revolutionary struggle. The thing that the movement is, you know, pushing back against isn't individual purchasing power or like choices of the types of commodities that we buy and how green they are. It's actually that we're trying to take on the structure of capitalism. And so we truly need a mass movement to take it on head on. And capitalism, in fact, is the driving force for climate change. Capitalism requires remarkable inequality and destruction, right, in order to continue to do its work. And it's always looking for new horizons of profit. And so, you know, those who are part of the underclass, the colonial underclass, or the global south, right, those who are really expendable within this larger calculation of global capitalism, those are the people we believe will populate this movement. And those are the folks we're talking about, and we're talking to in the Red Deal. One other major thing about the Red Deal is that we follow an abolitionist kind of tradition. There's always, right, this refrain like that mainstream politicians throw at revolutionaries or radicals, like, well, how are you going to implement that plan? Like, where are you going to get the money, you know, to do this amazing thing that you're proposing? And we're like, well, you could definitely divest from the military. So we believe in divesting, right, from state violence, from capitalism and military and imperial violence, and reinvesting that into what we call our common humanity, but not just in our people, right, but in the earth, because we have to heal the earth and our relationship with the earth, of course, in order to have any kind of future.
What other elements need to be abolished besides the military?
Defunding police, ICE, Customs and Border Protection and Child Protective Services, end border town violence, abolish incarceration, which includes the entire carceral spectrum, including cops and jails, end occupation everywhere, and abolish imperial borders. And so for us, these are the five key areas, right, in which imperialism does its work to police, surveil, and maim and kill, right, millions of people, if not billions of people across the globe. The Child Protective Services one, I think everyone has seen the news of these mass graves of Indigenous children, right, that are being discovered, quote unquote, in Canada and in the United States at former boarding schools. And the boarding schools are often thought of as the height of kind of colonial state abduction of children, right? As a type of genocide, a colonial technique to essentially erase future generations, right, of Indigenous people. And what I think a lot of people don't know is that in Canada, certainly, and definitely in the United States as well, but the child apprehension rate, like the number of Indigenous children who are in the custody of the colonial state, is actually larger than at the height of the residential and the boarding school era of the earlier part of the 20th century. And so even today, the technique is different, but Indigenous child removal is still a primary kind of tactic of colonial policy and genocide that Indigenous people continue to face. And so we wanted to include that because people don't talk much about it, but it's a really important aspect of the larger prison industrial complex, you know, carceral complex that the United States and Canada very much perpetrate. The Red Deal also has a bit of prophecy behind it because we believe there will be a future beyond capitalism. You know, we believe there will be a future beyond the United States because we existed before those two things came into existence. And despite the hardest work and the efforts of many who are the handmaidens of the agents of that violence of capitalism and settler colonialism, we never disappeared. And in fact, we're growing. And so we are evidence, you know, that this is not inevitable and that it is possible to build another world, you know, to emerge into another world, and that we are at the precipice of that change and that time of a new emergence. And we are here, we are waiting, we are ready.
That is such a powerful vision and so critical. What's the response that you've gotten to the Red Deal?
The reviews that we've received have been overwhelmingly positive. I think that it resonates with people. I think it resonates with young people. We literally hand the Red Deal out to our relatives on the street. You know, we want it in the hands of people, especially working class people and poor people and young people. And so I think those are the folks who've been primarily really inspired by it. And I think when it came out in April, it was like the number one or the number two selling book in Native American studies on Amazon.
Wow. If people want to get plugged in to both learn more and get more active, where would you suggest they go?
Our podcasts, I think, are the best thing we got going on right now. The Red Nation podcast, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. You can go to the Red Nation's Twitter feed or Instagram feed and find episodes there. You can join our Patreon. And, you know, as the pandemic hopefully starts to calm down, there will be much more, hopefully, action-based things that folks can get involved with in the future.
Is there anything else you want to say that I haven't asked you about or any final thoughts you want to leave us with?
The pandemic has been a trying time. And many of us, as we often do in the movement, go into crisis mode and emergency mode where, you know, we're just trying to stay afloat, whether we're trying to keep our communities afloat or just trying to survive ourselves. And, you know, the election of Joe Biden was not anything to celebrate. I've been chewed out by white liberals for saying that.
That's good.
That's good. But I would encourage people, even if you're in a state of despair, it's a hard time to be alive with what we're going through as a species, you know, as living beings on this planet. It is time to act. And whatever trauma or difficulties we're facing as individuals, it is actually important sometimes to put those things aside because what we're facing is not something we're facing on an individual level. It's a planetary level. And we must really rise to the occasion. And we needed to do it yesterday. And so I would just want to encourage everyone to be active again and to be really active. And let's build this liberation movement, because if ever there was a time to do it, it would be now.
Well said. And I so appreciate you sharing your just deeply inspiring vision and powerful resistance. And happy Indigenous Peoples Day.
Happy Indigenous Peoples Day.
That was Indigenous revolutionary activist Melanie Yazzi, co-founder of the Red Nation, co-author of The Red Deal, and professor at the University of New Mexico. You can hear the full interview with Pacifica producer Ken Fiale by clicking the link for this program at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. What is Genocide School? Veteran journalist, political prisoner, human rights activist, and acclaimed author Mumia Abu-Jamal of Prison Radio explains.
Genocide School. While most of us think of schools as a social good, in the history of some people, that has not been the case. Among Canada's Indigenous people, those we have come to call Indians, schools have become a place of pain, sorrow, and loss. For the better part of a century, these schools, called residential schools, were where Indigenous children came to be whipped, punished, and traumatized for the sin of not being white. First run by the government and later by the Roman Catholic Church, these schools became a site of horror, torture, and death. Recently, the ground surrounding the residential school in Kamloops, British Columbia, revealed the graves of over 200 Indigenous children. Subsequent searches have found hundreds of other children around so-called residential schools. I recently read a book by Native leader George Manuel, 1921-1989, entitled The Fourth World, published in 1974, who wrote of his school years in the following way. Three things stand out in my mind: hunger, speaking English, and being called a heathen because of my grandfather. On the day we arrived at the school, each new boy was assigned an interpreter who was a senior student. All the teachers were monks or devout lay Catholics. We called them brothers. In my first meeting with brothers, he showed me a long black leather strap and told me, through my interpreter, if you are ever caught speaking Indian, this is what you will get across your hands. Manuel, 63, 64. Kamloops, British Columbia, Canada. A site of genocide school. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Thanks to Prison Radio and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal for filing this report. Prison Radio is an independent multimedia production studio producing content for radio, television, and films for 30 years and distributing them throughout the world. Prison Radio's mission is to include the voices of incarcerated people in the public debate.
All from the Indians, welcome to pilgrims, and to the buffaloes who once ruled a plain. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Looking for the rain. Just like the cities that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. Winter in America. Yes, and all of the hills have been killed. Sent away. But the people know, the people know it's winter. Winter in America.
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Jacqueline Batiste. Water is life. Indigenous activists leading thousands of protests of Enbridge Tar Sands Line 3 pipeline in northern Minnesota say protect the wildlife. Veteran host and activist Mimi Rosenberg of Pacifica Station, WBAI New York, in conversation with Simone Sinaglis. She is Anishinaabe from the Red Lake Nation in northern Minnesota. Angel Stevens, an Anishinaabe from the White Earth Reservation, is a wild rice harvester and a member of the anti-pipeline movement.
I'm indigenous cause Jaganashamoin Gabopop Biganakog and Dunjaba. My name is Angel. I'm from the White Earth Reservation. I was born and raised there. I'm also part of the White Earth Constitutional Reform on the reservation. I'm an activist for Native rights. I feel like I'm a big part of this reservation.
I also was told one other thing by Simone, that you're the mother of one of the youngest activists. So who is that youngest activist and how young?
My pride and joy, his name is Silas Nealon. He's 13. We're actually from the small community of Rice Lake, which is located right on the southern part of White Earth Reservation. And yeah, he's actually sitting right here too.
Simone, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are? Then we'll really get into the meat of the incredible and arduous campaign work that you folks have been doing.
Yeah, and I think that Angela and Silas are actually right now on the ground doing it.
We're right outside of Bagley on the Clearwater River, right on Highway 2. We were notified earlier that there was a frack out. And actually, yeah, Ron was just here, Simone, and he was here with his drone, and he verified that and it was indeed a frack out, and that's what they're doing over there right now, cleaning it up.
Holy smokes, holy smokes.
We're going to get back to that in a minute. You're going to tell us a lot more about what's going on there, what it is, after we find out what brings Simone to the struggle. This is, it's breaking, and I want to find out more, too.
Buju, Chinotami Kwe, Indigenikas, Squagami, Wizaga, Iganing, and Donjiba, Anishinaabe Kwe, and Dao, Migizi, and Dudain. My name is Simone. My family is from the Red Lake Nation here in northern Minnesota. Although I was raised in the city in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and also lived a long time in Bemidji, Minnesota. My clan is Eagle Clan. And we are Anishinaabe. These home territories where Line 3 is going through, so it's important to us on the global scale. scale, but it's also just, it's our homelands. It's our home territories. And I work for the Indigenous Environmental Network, where I've worked for the past 20 years on environmental justice issues within Indian country.
We're going to go right back, since we're in the middle of something now, to Angel. Angel, tell us more exactly about what you just found out and what you and Silas are doing on that land, and where that fits in to the struggle around stopping the Line 3 pipeline. Angel?
The Clearwater River, it's located near Bagley, Minnesota, and I live like 13 miles away from here, which is south of Bagley on the reservation. We just discovered a frack out, and this Clearwater River is also on the Minnesota Impaired Rivers list because it has wild rice on it. Yeah, the Enbridge has had a big effect on our wild rice season. Big effect.
Talk to us about what the implications is, particularly since you're talking to somebody like me who is so urban. I don't even begin to understand the wild rice. Talk about it and the importance of the culture and industry of Anishinaabe people.
Wild rice is the reason why the Anishinaabe are basically here. According to our teachings, we migrated east along 7 stopping signs, or the east coast over there, and we migrated west over to the land here in Minnesota, where they said at our final stopping place, we will find the food that grows on water. In the Minnesota, Wisconsin, Canada, I'm even finding out there was even a wild rice lake in Texas. You know, that surprised me. It made me happy, but it surprised me that we are the keepers of this. We take care of this food that grows on water. We are the protectors of this wild rice. And
well, it's happening in real time in our real lives. You know, we're seeing the destruction and the impacts that Angel is talking about, like literally in real time when we're in our communities, when we're driving down the road. You know, the effects that Enbridge is having on our waters and lands and our wild rice, it's right there.
Yeah, tell us more about Enbridge and what that really looks like, and how Enbridge is destroying really the wild rice, which is part of the entire culture of a people and part of its current staple and reality for sustenance and so on.
Enbridge is a Canadian corporation coming into our homeland, and they're putting in this pipeline, their oil coming from Canada straight through our lands to go to a boat by Lake Superior, and then it's going to be cargoed off to another country. I see no benefits to where would benefit us at all. You know, there's like, how many pipelines are moving across this country? There's so many going right now that it's predicted that we won't have any of those resources by, like, what, 2030, 2050, and that we'll have to start conserving in some way. And yet they're continuing to build pipelines across our homelands. Been many, many tribes that have said, no, we don't want your pipeline. My own tribe here, White Earth Nation, we said no to the pipeline. So they built it alongside our borders to our reservation. But what they didn't know was that they were building it in 1855 treaty land, which gave us the inherent right to hunt, gather fish on those same lands. So that also gives us the say, you know, what's going to happen to those resources that we're using on that land. So far, the state of Minnesota has not even recognized our voice. They have not recognized us as people that actually live here, that vote. My own tribe right now has a court case along with Red Lake and a couple organizations that Enbridge, this Canadian corporation that's building this pipeline, is violating the rights of our Monomen. You know, we actually have it in our constitution. Our Monomen has rights. Like, it has life. It gives us life. I've come to terms that Native people are disregarded. They're seen as people that should have assimilated long time ago, that should have learned to live the way that was forced upon them. But we did it. You know, we're resilient. We rise above things. My grandma, she was orphaned at a boarding school. You know, that's how she was raised. but she made it home, you know, and that's the people that you're going to meet out there. This is home to them. This is why they're fighting out there. Tribes are going to start to get recognized as that more and more of us are going to be standing up.
Simone Sinangles with the Indigenous Environmental Network and Anishinaabe from the Red Lake Nation of Ojibwe in northern Minnesota, and Angel Stevens, an Anishinaabe wild rice harvester and a member of the anti-pipeline Menominee camp, and Silas Nealon, one of the youngest Indigenous water protector warriors.
The Anishinaabe people are rallying to save their lakes and their traditional wildlife harvests. The Line 3 pipeline project in Minnesota, if completed, will move up to 915,000 barrels of tar sands oil per day from Alberta, Canada to Superior, Wisconsin. Tar sands oil is one of the dirtiest energy sources on the planet. The 337-mile stretch of pipeline now being built in Minnesota would cross Anishinaabe treaty lands, threatening their sacred wild rice crop, which requires clean water to grow. Thanks to Mimi Rosenberg of WBAI New York for this report.
Time traveler running faster, warrior is born, battle to be won, past trauma, future hurt. I'm a child of the dirt and I'm ready to give birth. Planting a dream, panting I breathe, running towards the future with a handful of seeds. Stronger than greed, I am stronger than hate. I stand under the shades of trees planted so long ago, a product of ancestral love. I'm here because my elders dance in the sun. They would give it all up for us, and from day one it was practiced like religion to prepare for the ones to come.
We are here. Forgot truth, you forgot how to live for a time beyond you. It's not about you, it's not about you. It's about the song that is traveling through. It travels through time. Singers will die, but the song lives on through matrilineal lines.
We are here.
We're not in charge, nature's in charge. Look to the stars, remember who you are. Stay humble or fall, we don't know it all. And we are not exempt from natural law. Live selfishly and the structure will fall. But if we live for those unborn, then the song will go on. So before you take a book off the shelf, take a look inside yourself. Answers come to you at light speed. I'm searching for knowledge that I can't find on a...
This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Jacqueline Batiste. On the Texas coast, the indigenous people known as Karankawa have been misrepresented historically, said to be extinct, and to have been cannibals. Karankawa traditional territory is from Galveston Bay to Corpus Christi Bay. The indigenous peoples of Coastal Bend and other environmental groups have sued the Army Corps of Engineers over a permit to Moda Midstream. Moda Ingleside Energy Center is the largest crude oil storage and export terminal by volume in the United States. It's headquartered in Houston. The permit allows Moda to dredge about 3.9 million cubic yards of material out of Corpus Christi Bay. Here's Love Sanchez representing the Karankawa Kadla, Kadla meaning culturally mixed. She's a co-founder of the Indigenous Peoples of Coastal Bend.
Yeah, so my name is Love Sanchez. I was born and raised in the Corpus Christi Bay Area. I'm a co-founding member of the Indigenous Peoples of the Coastal Bend. We established ourselves in 2018. However, our organization is intertribal, and of course we have allies and people that are part of our planning circles that are non-native. So the majority of our group is indigenous to this area. Our group consists of Lipan Apache, Apache, Kuankulkala, and Korontekans, which the Korontekans was like a bunch of bands. You know, our coach was trying to kind of get away from that term, because there were so many bands that were like grouped together, which was not right. That's what the Spaniards did. So I think a lot of people are trying to find their identity with that particular term. However, that's still a term. So so that's the makeup of our organization. We kind of knew each other prior to like kind of getting a little bit more organized, formally organized. In 2015, we all met each other.
How has the 2015 lifting of the crude oil export ban affected your part of the coast?
We started to see a lot of like expansion, like permutations going on, and we had some watchdogs looking out. That's what I call our researchers, that were like noticing this pattern of like, okay, you know, the ban was lifted and here we're starting to see some more applications and people wanting to move to this area. We established ourselves through protecting the water and the land. I mean, really, we weren't as organized as we are now. I feel we're organized. We're still getting organized, but I feel like we're just so much collectively and strategic now. Like, it's pretty amazing. Now we're a collective.
On December 14th, Corpus Christi residents were instructed not to use the water due to a potential contaminant in the city's water supply. The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality revealed that there was no backflow protection device installed at Valero Marketing and Supply Company and numerous internal cross connections to the drinking water supply system at Aragon Asphalt. Can you talk about that?
The water boils happened. We made national news. It was kind of like limelight on us making national news because we're having water boils and we have like an industry expansion going on and stuff. So a water boil is whenever the city kind of says, hey, you know what, if you want to consume the water, you have to boil it. Yeah, kill off the germs kind of thing. And I was like, nah, we're not drinking that water at all. We hadn't drank that water. I think the last time I drank the Corpus water was like when I was a teenager, and I'm 39. So I think it was like the last time I drank water, the faucet water, was like I was about 14 years old. We met each other through protesting in 2015 against what was happening because there was water boils that were connected to the Valero refinery. At the time when we were like doing indigenous rights, we were trying to like amplify what's happening with people of color, black women, indigenous communities, especially with like missing and murdered indigenous women. And like, we got a proclamation. We actually got two proclamations in 2018 and 2019. So 2018 was Indigenous Tribes of the Coastal Band, was our first proclamation we got with the city. Then the second one was in 2019. We got Indigenous Peoples of the Coastal Band, which replaced Columbus Day in our city. And it read that every second Tuesday of October would be proclaimed Indigenous Peoples Day.
How you've been working through this COVID situation?
Oh, it's been a struggle because we're very used to being in the presence of one another. And I think that's just like human nature, period. Not just like our culture. I think it's just like a human thing that we want to be connected and be around other people, you know? We lost that, you know? Like, we had to figure out ways to interact. We would do drum circles on Zoom. And that's the way we were trying to connect. And things and plans that we had pre-COVID, we adopted a park. And it was in the middle of the barrio, which is like the east side, west side, where it was predominantly black and brown people. And I grew up in that area. And so I was like, man, we should, you know, get this community, this public space going where we can interact with people and get more people involved with them maybe wanting to find their roots or just connecting to us if they feel the connection of being native or whatever. They just feel the connection, period, you know. Wanting to be around us. And so we lost that. So we had to figure out ways like, okay, we're going to be doing stuff virtually, social media. Okay, we're going to have to invest in platforms that are going to allow people to sign petitions formally. We had to figure out, okay, the signatures, you know how these signatures have to be legit. Well, now we have PDF versions where you can literally have your formal signature on there. There's so many things that evolved from 2020, but I mean, it's a sad time, you know, what we're still kind of going through.
Actually, is George Floyd's birthday. I wonder if you had some thought around that.
So here in Corpus, it's pretty amazing to see what happened during that time and now. And so basically we're a conservative city. So to see a protest happen with over 1,000 teenagers and young adults out there in the streets of Corpus going downtown, I was like, whoa, where have y'all been, you know?
Your organization has a lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Okay, so the lawsuit was filed sometime in August, and our lawyers decided that these certain acts were good, how do I say it? And so the three federal acts that we're challenging is the Clean Water Act, the National Wildlife Act, and the Administrative Procedure Act. I can't really say too much about the case, only that it's ongoing. But a month later, September the 7th, Enbridge is a company that's notorious for, like, doing pipelines over treating lands of Native Americans throughout the nation. And they bought MODA, because they are the leading transporter of crude oil in the nation. I'm like, oh, I know exactly why you did it. MODA is the largest oil export terminal in the nation. And so for the leading transporter to buy the leading export, it's not a surprise. I was like, okay, this ain't checkmate though yet, because we're still going to keep going.
Love Sanchez, representing the Kuankwa on the Texas coast.
So how do we become resilient? It's feeling the blood of the women ancestors in my veins, finding our voice and being strong enough and brave enough to get up and talk about our experience. Revitalization.
Hopi elder and spiritual messenger Thomas Binyaka, born June 2, 1909, was selected as a spokesperson for the traditional Hopi leaders in 1948 after the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which triggered Hopi awareness that the prophesied gourd full of ashes had finally appeared.
This area, the Hopi were led into by ancient people. They have four sacred mountains in this four corners area, surrounded by shrines built on the long time ago, and this is the spiritual center or heart of Mother Earth. So they said, we must leave this in natural state, because if we rip up this earth from all around the world, people for money and job and good time and just rip it up. But if we leave up in this four corners area in natural state that the Great Spirit made, just leave it that way and hold it by prayer, fast, ritual, ceremony, every month to keep this land life in balance for not only here but around the world. And we went on four directions to hold this in balance through a ceremony. That's why they take different societies to take care of that. They sing, pray, fast, meditate. And that's how we keep this nature in balance. And that's what the Hopi is trying to hold on to now, and other Native people, to perform the ceremony so that this world will continue on. You can have all inventions, but you can't stop rain. When they're really coming down, or earthquake, or tornadoes, hurricane, when it comes, that invention of white man can't stop it. It got to come from the heart of a future people who knows what to sing and how to perform a ceremony and other things, and that would keep this in balance. Well, how I do that, the white man, he sings up in the moon. The same thing, I'm first here. If I ask white man, are you here first? The second came, he was here first. Do you know, can you explain that? Is that your symbol? See, we were here long, long, long time ago before any white people came.
Kuchiba over my uncle.
I am only here to bring my message from the elders to spring people and other people and living things on this earth who are here, and I know that our spirit people are here, the plant, water, and all the birds, animal things that were here. And I'm sure that there are other sacred sites here which our ancestors left long time ago. And I'm glad to see this water is still here, and I hope it will continue to give water to every living things on this earth. These things are protected by Hopi long time ago. So that's why I felt I need to bring this message. So it's the Second World War. The Native people were not supposed to go in the army, Hopi and Native people. The government knows that, but they forced a lot of our people to go in the army and send them off to foreign country and disturb them in life. We're not supposed to do that. We're not to throw bomb over there. And so Second World War, I didn't go there. I just refused to register for army or anything. So FBI caught me and told me that they will help me out if I agree to go to army. And I said, no, I decide on this thing because my spirituality, my Hopi, and it's come from my heart, and I'm going to stand on it. And I'm not going to go to other foreign countries. It's not our war, it's your war. You, the one white man, create that. You should go over there, but not Native people, because our Native people's special mission is to take care of the Western hemisphere through prayer, ceremony, ritual, and living in this area, take care of animal, birds, and plant life, and grass and trees. And that's what I'm going to do, and I want to stay with my Hopis. I want to be Hopi because Hopi means peaceful person, kind, gentle, truthful, humble person, and I want to help keep this land alive in that way. FBI and U.S. Marshal got hold of me and threw me in jail. I spent almost 7 years in prison trying to be good Hopi. White people don't understand this kind of thing. They only look for money and job and good time. They don't care about land. They wanted to sell and buy and destroy everything. That's what the old people say he's going to do. He's going to switch tongue and he's going to take everything from you. He's going to even make you believe a lie when he tells you right in front of you. He knows how to give you one thing and take something away from you quickly. This kind of thing, they explain that that's exactly what's going on right now. And so they told us when they do that, someplace they're going to start suffer terrible things like earthquake, flooding, tornadoes, upheaval, land, and tidal wave, because we have not correct change, stop wrong things. And so that's why we want the United Nations to give them a chance, give all the foreign government a chance to do something with their laws or regulations. And it's up to the people now. In the first, second world, people didn't do nothing to the leaders. So it's up to the people in the fourth world, because we are the children of these mothers. We are the ones who are supposed to correct change in some of these leaders. Because you are voters, taxpayers, they are your servants. You are the government, you are the power. You're supposed to do something, but if you don't, then nature's going to really take over. There's no way you can save many people. This is where we are right now. We either bring about Third World War, Fourth World War, or destroy ourselves, or disturb nature so much, nature is going to act so strongly, well, there's no way to survive. But if we find this to be true, then we correct change and stop this wrongdoing and make this life beautiful, clean again.
Spiritual messenger Thomas Binyaka was one of four Hopi elders named to reveal prophecies as well as traditional wisdom and teachings of the Hopi. Binyaka was a member of the Wolf, Fox, and Coyote clans. He transitioned to the ancestral plane on February 6, 1999. On June 2011, Santa Clara Elder Jose Lacero and Onondaga Chief Warren Lyons organized a memorial gathering to celebrate and honor his life at the foothills of the Navajo Mountains. That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contributed to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by KPFT's Jacqueline Batiste and Akua Holt. Executive producers of COVID Race and Democracy are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltser. You can find this and all previous episodes on our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Jacqueline Batiste. Thanks for listening.